The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics. Brian is for years I've known him, a key analyst of the federal marketplace, particularly done a lot of work on IDIQ contracts and GWACs and all that part of the marketplace. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Roger.
Well, I'm looking forward to this discussion, but I guess first I got to start with the big question. One Nation Analytics, a new adventure. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so over the years, I've gotten a lot of requests from folks for detailed data analytics around government contract opportunities, around market sizing, around how the budget and procurement intersect. And I felt like right now was a really good time to launch a new company because big data is hitting every market, including this market, the federal market. We see it in the way that agencies are conducting source selections for some of the biggest vehicles this spring that we'll probably talk about later.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in the way that agencies are evaluating the performance of their vendors. It's a big data world, and federal procurement's not immune to that.
Right. Well, it's exciting to me, and I'm glad to have you on your show. This is sort of like you get a public launch to a certain extent here, right? On the
radio
show a little bit.
This is right. This is the big debut for One Nation Analytics. I just started out 3 weeks ago, and one of the reasons I did it now was because there's so much happening in the market right now where people need bespoke custom help.
Sure.
With the data to help them make better decisions.
Sure. So why don't we just, I guess peel the onion back a little bit there. And I guess for me, and I am truly just a lay person, attorney by training, not all that techie savvy, right? But so when you talk about big data, okay, in the context of the government marketplace and its use in decision making, what are you seeing going on there?
Well, one thing is that big data. So big data, a lot of times people
I can't even get my head around the concept of big data.
Well,
I guess
because it means something different to everybody, right? But in one sense, it means a lot of data, right?
Yes.
But what makes big data valuable is the interconnections between the various data sets, right? And it's becoming easier and easier to make those connections, and from a technology perspective. Through XML, through APIs that allow you to pull in data and cross-reference them. And even from a policy perspective, the Digital Accountability and Transparency Act is pushing agencies to make their data interactive and able to cross-reference with other data points. So what we're really going to see over the next few years is increased ability to connect existing data on procurements that are underway to the opportunities that are coming down the pike, to the budgets that are funding them, and even to the requirements that the agencies are laying out that feed those budgets, that feed those procurements.
Right. So you're really talking about those interconnections. Somebody I worked in government for a long time, those are always been there. But like sort of, I guess, pulling back the curtain so that you can see that those on the outside can see how, the different pieces drive different, behaviors and that sort of thing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to see how all of those pieces connect, right? One of my favorite sayings is policy drives procurement. An RFI or an RFP doesn't appear magically out of nowhere. Way back before there was even an inkling of an RFI, there was someone in Congress or the administration that identified a policy problem that applied budget resources to it and then t- told the agency to go figure out how to solve that problem. And it's been hard up till now because all the data lives in different stovepipes for people to take them and pull them together and see, okay, if this policy, if this problem is manifesting itself now, how is it going to play out through the process? How can I start anticipating
where the contracts are going to come? And I mean, measuring timelines and that sort of thing to see when the cause and effect result in an action, I guess.
Right.
Sure. Interesting. This might be a sideways question, but I have to ask you about it because you were talking about the interrelated nature of the data and trying to pull, connect all the dots, sort of. Well, there's a mosaic effect, right, to that. That's how I've heard you describe that. And I'm just wondering, transparency is a good thing overall, but at a certain point, is connecting all the dots and that, how does that impact those who aren't exactly friendly to us? Like if you're connecting the dots and they're looking at, will those who, whether it's cyber and, China, analyzing what our behaviors through this information or others, should there be any sense of concern about that or not?
My sense is that the government has done a good job over the past decade, particularly after 9/11, of really examining the security of that data to prevent just that. So, for example, the Defense Department's procurement data is on a 90-day delay for public release. That's so that a adversary couldn't try and put two and two together by looking at where logistics contracts are being awarded and figure out where troop movements are going to occur. And a number of agencies that used to report their data publicly, National Geospatial Intelligence Agency and Defense Intelligence Agency, stopped, again, out of concern about the ability of enemies to use that information. So my general sense is that the government has done a pretty good job of isolating.
Right. It's a fair question, though, I think, right? Or not? I mean, you have to be balanced. I mean, transparency is a good thing, but maybe too much transparency may not be, right? I don't know. Like seeing somebody in the shower or in the locker room. I don't know. I don't know what the right word is, but.
Yeah, no, and you do have to be careful there, right? With it's not just from a national security perspective, but also from a corporate security perspective. Companies give the government a lot of proprietary information, and the government has to be careful not to let that people come in through those connection points and access data they shouldn't have.
Right. So, why don't we keep talking a little bit about, one of the pieces of data that I think the government is reorganizing to use is, and I'm talking category management. Okay.
Yeah.
What is category management from your perspective as you see what the government's doing there?
Yeah. And I think the government's still figuring out what it means by category management. The concept, comes from the corporate world where large enterprises, large corporations try to get central control over the purchases of commodities to wring out savings, to get goods to people that need them more quickly, and just to manage it in a sort of a coherent fashion rather than having lots of people throughout large organizations buying in very different ways and potentially wasting money and time. Applied to the government, I think this is a really fascinating concept because I struggle with the question of, is there such a thing as the government?
Right.
The government as an enterprise, when you've got such diverse organizations as the Navy, as the Weather Service, the Forest Service, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Interior Department.
Right.
All the, National Park Service, all those things.
And
right?
the missions are so varied and it's so huge, such a huge enterprise, that I'm not sure that the category management idea works the way people might imagine it would. Why can't they just buy like Walmart, right? Well, Walmart is a very discrete organization with a very specific mission across the entire enterprise.
Right.
And the government's different. So I think that's going to be a struggle for the application of the idea. But that said, it's stepping back a little bit, it's a manifestation of the idea that the government should be buying like a business or thinking like a business when it goes to acquisition, rather than procurement being driven by policy. Like if you think about most Office of Federal Procurement policy administrators have been lawyers.
Right. Well, yeah, Brian, that's a great place to stop. And we'll pick that up when we come back, because that is the crux of the matter. Is the government acting like a commercial buyer or not? My guest today is Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics. And Brian, when we took that break, you were starting to go down one of my favorite discussion points is, some of the impetus behind category management is to, sort of adopt a more, commercial-like approach to purchasing, or at least organizing the way you are buying. And you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think what struck me about the early stages of category management is that what's come out is a whole new set of policies that that sort of serve to increase the regulatory burden on agencies. So while the goal is to act more like a business, sometimes the government has trouble not acting more like the government and just layering on additional
guidance, yeah, memos, yeah,
right, and not taking anything away, right,
right.
And so the category management at the end of the day is an attempt to streamline the procurement process, right, in the corporate world,
and right.
I have yet to see it as a streamlining mechanism in the government.
Yeah, and well, that's a interesting point, because it does. To me, and I use your thoughts on this, it's pretty straightforward, right? I mean, to me, it's like eliminating processes that don't add value and writing better requirements. If category management leads to that, I think it will be good. The question that you just raised is it's an additional layer in a certain sense that's being, I think it's your thoughts on that. It's like you have the departments and the agencies, how they're already organized and their procurement operations are organized. GSA can reorganize itself internally to reflect category management, and it's going through that process. But for other agencies, it's like they're trying to put an additional layer, and category managers from across the, different agencies or departments to sort of manage it.
I guess
on a government-wide basis. And I just wonder.
That's a very government way to do it, right? Create additional positions.
Right.
And additional committees. And at the end of the day, one challenge is that there's not, again, it gets back to the question of, is the government an enterprise? There's not one person who can say across government, this is how we're going to buy it. You have to create these new organizational structures and these new policy structures precisely because everybody is off doing their own thing and you need to coordinate. And so I wonder if the real action in terms of category management as a method of streamlining procurement and making the government act more like business will really end up happening at the agency level. And maybe for some commodities, the successes at agency level will bubble up to government wide, and people will say, "Oh well, I'll just buy this very commoditized thing the same way that agency is doing it because it makes sense
right.
for me."
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned the new pro. I mean, because we've got now we had the Strategic Sourcing Leadership Council. Now it's the Category Management Leadership Council that's coming together to try to, sort of figure this all out. And and that dynamic, and there always is like. Yeah, having done this for 30 years, there's periods where people want to decentralize things, or it led to the Clinger-Cohen Act and repeal the Brooks Act for central acquisition of IT. Then there's these pendulum swings, the old cliche, and all things need to be more centralized. It seems like we're in sort of a more centralization focus right now.
Yeah, and corporations go through this too, right?
Absolutely.
They decide to empower employees.
Yep.
And then they realize that there are inefficiencies when you empower everybody, and so they pull it back in. And so at the end of the day, it's sort of a natural cycle, but we're definitely in the phase of that cycle where things are mm-hmm. coming into a more consolidated approach.
Right. Well, and the flip side of it is what's going on in the private sector in reaction to either category management or just some of the acquisition strategies that are the perceptions of what's going on out there. And I think we're really talking maybe about the M&A world.
There's been a huge increase in deals this year, right? We see Lockheed Martin splitting off its services business and Leidos merging with that business. L3 spinning off its services division and CACI taking that on. CSC splitting its commercial business from its government business, and then its government business merging with SRA. Mm-hmm. And across all of these, there's some common themes, one of which is that the financial markets, looking at the margins that government contractors can get versus what commercial providers can get, don't see good synergy there. And so the companies are incentivized by the market to split off your commercial business from your government business. So it's this interesting dichotomy when we think about category management being government trying to act more like a business, with the market saying what we see is that the government is so different from the commercial sector that they should be separate businesses.
So companies are reacting by consolidating?
By splitting up their commercial and government business and then consolidating within among businesses that have similar margins. So Babcock and Wilcox is a big energy department and Navy nuclear contractor, split into two. Its government services business separated off from its more profitable energy services business. If you look at the Lockheed split up, the hardware and weapon system business, which acquired Sikorsky, is a higher margin business. The services business is lower margin. And so first you see the margin separation, and then when you have segmented off lower margin businesses, a lower margin business, in order to be successful, has to grow revenue. And the one way to grow revenue is to combine forces with another company. So you've got economies of scale. You can cut internal costs to get some margin improvement. And so what we're seeing now is the consolidation of the services companies in this market. But we can't forget that the first step was the market saying there's not good synergies between the commercial and the government businesses here.
And I think the lesson learned there is the government needs to be more like the commercial marketplace, right? I mean, to that point, and you know, we've heard the comment, we're the biggest buyer in the world, you know, of commercial products and services. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, if you look at the biggest companies in the world, let's talk about Microsoft and Google, Facebook. Government is just a fraction,
a percent.
You know, you often see companies not even reporting government as a material customer, which they're required to do if the government is at least 10% of their business. Often, you know, with the IBMs and the Accentures of the world, we're looking at 3%, 5% of the business. So so I think there still is a perception within the government that the government has this ability to
shape markets,
but it's only within, that's only true within the segment of the economy that's entirely focused on government.
Well, you're talking about like weapon systems or government unique functions that, you know, certain companies, you know, produce product for, right? Really,
right.
So weapon systems.
Yeah.
So, and what does that, what does that dynamic tell you? Because you hear, a lot of the, DoD talks about seeking innovation and understanding they don't drive innovation like they used to maybe 30 years ago, right? That the commercial marketplace drives innovation much, basically completely in many instances, but at the same time, at the operational level, that hasn't translated yet. Is that just a function of, the government and the way it works and the way things translate, or is it, the point in time we are in a particular administration? I mean, what is that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you think back the last time there was this real big push by the government to really try and adopt commercial practices writ large was in the 1990s, right?
Yeah.
And I don't think we're going to see in the very near term another Clinger Cohen Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act kind of movement, but I wouldn't be surprised if sometime in the middle of the next decade, the government realizes that that it's just not going to be able to incentivize largely commercial companies to play with the government unless they make it easier for them.
Right. And that maybe that's one of the outgrowths of category management. But along the lines of category management, something you said, perhaps at the end of the day, this will be done at the agency level. Is there a balance there between agencies, like, because contract duplication is a big issue that I hear about it all the time, still all the time from companies. Is there a way to thread that needle, with sort of an installed base of shared services? What I mean by that is a set of contracts like what GSA does, basically what GSA does, and allow and promote more use of those type of vehicles rather than creating your own. I mean, that's where OFPP is attempting to go with, which I guess presume will be released soon, is their updated business case analysis. I know you've done a lot of work in the number of IDIQs and contract duplication. Have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, so in this case, I think the policy coming out of OFPP is lagging the practice in the agencies. So in my analysis over the years, the number of contract vehicles was rising until about 2013, and then it started to fall off. And that's because, simply put, agencies created way more supply of contract vehicles than there was demand. There's just massive excess capacity in these vehicles. And on their own, agencies have been realizing that it's been kind of a waste of time for them to create, billion-dollar vehicles that end up seeing $75 million in task orders. And so there was already sort of this natural progression of agencies saying, let's not do this IDIQ again. Let's go out and see if there's already a vehicle that we can use. And I think that the timing is really good that and GSA, sort of looking out across the market and seeing this, has responded by creating some vehicles that are attractive across the government. And so I do think that we are going to see continuing decline in the number of contract vehicles and expansion of the use of the government-wide acquisition contracts and a few of the agency-level vehicles.
Right. It's interesting because, I think maybe it would be interesting if you could take a look at through One Nation Analytics at the very top end. Because I still hear from companies at the very top end, the big ones, there is still a significant amount of overlap between Encore 3 could theoretically be done through Alliant, a lot of that work, that kind of thing. Just that kind of concern.
Yeah.
And whether you could stratify the market to see, because, definitely I think in the area of internal agency duplication of itself, that's been going on for a long time, and it sounds like they're addressing that. Maybe perhaps, does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, so the Encore 3 and Alliant, these are IT services contracts, and I guess duplication is all relative. So in the knowledge-based services space, the Army alone has a few hundred contract vehicles. When you look at the IT services space, there are really only about 100. Vehicles that are of any significance across the government. Now, I'm saying only 100 because it's relative, right? That's still a lot. But
right. And then right now we have to take our break. When we come back, we'll talk about that 100 and maybe some of the big competitions that are coming up this spring. My guest today is Brian Friel. He is with One Nation Analytics, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics. Okay, so Brian, first, I have to ask you the question and maybe put this on the spot.
Yeah.
Why One Nation Analytics?
So it's from the One Nation is from the Pledge of Allegiance. I have a needlepoint that my grandmother stitched, 40 years ago, hanging on my wall, and it looked at it and said that's the name.
Very cool. That's very cool. I like that. Very good. And well, we don't have One Nation of government contracts, right?
We have,
and that's why you're in business, right? You got many, many different contract vehicles. And when we took the break, you were mentioning, about 100 major IT, I guess I'll call them major, I'll use that descriptor, IT contracts out there in that space. And only 100, Brian?
I know, right? I guess you're right. That's a lot.
So with that, in that regard, I know there's a bunch of competitions coming up this year. Let's dive into that for this segment and, what you see going on in the marketplace in terms of upcoming contract vehicles.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the big one of the year is Alliant 2 and Alliant 2 Small Business. So already the existing Alliant contracts are generating about $4 billion a year in obligations. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Alliant 2 contracts together surpass $5 billion a year by 2020. Again, because we're seeing agencies giving up the ghost on some of their contract vehicles and already committing to move work to the Alliant contract and other GSA vehicles like the Defense Health Agency just did. Rather than create a new contract, it committed to use the GWACs, including Alliant, for about $5 billion in upcoming requirements. And so this one is fascinating for a couple reasons, not only because of the size, but also because it is using this kind of data-driven approach to evaluation where companies self-score themselves on a scale of 75,600 points.
Okay.
And if you get more points, if you self-score and GSA validates that you have more points than the 61st bidder for the unrestricted version or the 81st bidder for the small business version, you're in. And if you have fewer than those points, you're out. And and that's a very data-driven approach. As one of my initial services, I've used publicly available information to estimate all of the likely bidders for the contract and where they're going to come down, and you can see what the consequences are as the government moving more and more to this kind of approach, which I think they will. For one thing, it reduces the chances of protest,
right?
And for another, it does give you a set of companies that are very experienced doing business with government agencies. So you're
right.
Sort of
pre-qualified. Well, the Alliant team has picked up on the Oasis, and we're going to talk about Oasis at some point today, but they've picked up on the Oasis evaluation model and are using the same model.
Yeah.
And the protest issue is interesting. I don't know what the right term is. I don't want to say clever, ingenious, but the approach where you're self-scoring. So if you self-score yourself too low and you're not in the top, you're not high enough to be in the cutoff to be one of the awardees. Like, that's on you.
Yeah.
There's nothing. I mean, what are you going to protest?
Right.
It's in a certain sense, brilliant approach to doing the evaluation from a pure, litigation avoidance perspective.
Right. Using this kind of data is very objective, right?
Right.
It takes subjectivity. There's no adjectival ratings.
Right.
Here. You either get the points or you don't.
So, and the other thing that struck me in your description of it is you're saying now Alliant, the current Alliant and Alliant Small Business are up to about $4 billion annually in obligations orders.
In obligations.
Uh-huh. That's pretty, back in the day I was in GSA when Alliant was being created and, the $50 billion, ceiling on Alliant, and then I think it was 15 under Alliant Small Business. At the time, that was like, wow, those are big numbers. And it sounds like over time, the market is moving in that direction. I mean, it's not, those aren't unreasonable. I mean, from what you're telling me, those aren't unreasonable at this point.
No. I think if anything, the Alliant Too Small Business ceiling might end up being too small, because what we see on the Oasis contract, which is for knowledge-based services and other, you know, professional services, that the bulk of the orders are being awarded through the small business track. And I wouldn't be surprised if Alliant to Small Business ends up carrying a much larger share of the order flow than Alliant Small Business has.
Right. Well, that's one thing. And, you know, there's always change and consistency. And I think one of the consistent themes of the, and it's bipartisan in its approach, is supporting small business, right? So that, having that, I think you're probably right about that. Absolutely. So another, you know, what are the other big ones going on?
So
get some debrief on some of those, or a briefing on some of those.
Yeah. Here. So the Alliant 2, you know, RFP is set to come out this spring. Before that, we'll probably see the RFP for Encore 3, the Defense Information Systems Agency's IT services contract, which has a similar scope. In that case, again, sort of, if you read through the RFP, it's not as strictly data-driven as Alliant, but it is moving in that direction. For one thing, it's lowest price technically acceptable competition, which is really unusual for the IDIQ, and at the IDIQ level rather than at the task order level. And also, when you look at the technical requirements, they're very much sort of data-driven, check-the-box kind of responses.
So again, that's kind of an approach that, if you, from a litigation perspective, it's going to limit the window of potential, you know, ways to challenge the awardees, or even the RFP for that matter. Is that,
yeah,
correct?
That's right. And, you know, but I think one thing that will be a consequence of the decision to go LPTA for Encore 3 is that a lot of that work will move to vehicles like Alliant, because there's higher end work that's being done on that contract that buyers are unlikely to place on a contract that is structured as a low bid contract. So I would actually think, while Alliant will see a big increase in orders compared to Alliant 2 compared to Alliant, I think Encore 3 might end up being smaller than Encore 2 in terms of order flow.
Right. So that acquisition strategy is actually will potentially create opportunities for other contract vehicles, right? That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah. And so you'll have commoditized type work that agencies deem commoditized, that they're comfortable going with a lowest bidder wins strategy, staying on that contract or maybe moving to that contract from other places, but then your higher end cybersecurity type work going elsewhere.
Yeah. So, and any other ones you want to mention?
Yeah, the Army has ITES 3S.
Oh, yes, right? There is. Okay.
The VA has T4NG, which is going to be awarded. It's already in source selection. There are several in source selection right now. The Army has one called RS3 for knowledge-based services. C4D's final rolling admissions period is underway right now. There's an on-ramp for the Chief Information Officer Solutions and Partners 3 small business contract. And I wouldn't be surprised to see some on-ramps gearing up in the short term for Oasis. And once all the dust settles by the middle of next year, I think we'll have in place the main contract vehicles for services acquisition that will be used in the next decade. There won't be that many IDIQ, big, huge, you know, massive, major IDIQ competitions after that for some period of years.
Right. And I guess, and, you know, to your point about big data and data, that will provide a framework too to see, you know, basically what's, I think, an even clearer framework of what's working, what's not working potentially, right?
Yeah.
I
mean, because work will consolidate onto those contracts.
Right.
It'll be easier to analyze.
What I'm thinking is, like, your observations about Encore 3, it will be a more of a commodity type contract vehicle, and higher end stuff will move to other vehicles. They'll be able to measure that, or at least get some sense of it in terms of thinking about, you know, what makes sense the next time around for right. that type of contract vehicle.
Yeah.
You know what? We're already up on the break. But when we come back, we'll continue the discussion of some of these contracts, maybe talk a little more about Z40 and Oasis, perhaps, and also maybe even a little bit about the presidential election. I guess procurement reform was mentioned in one of the debates. Who would have thunk of that? Wow. My guest today is Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics, and you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics. And Brian, when we took the break, you had mentioned in the last segment Z40 and Oasis, and I thought we'd talk a little bit more about them, at least to start off here, and maybe we can do some presidential, election stuff too. But first, so Z40, what's going on in that space? You mentioned that the last, I guess, open season type period is upon us here. What does that sort of mean, and what does the future of that contract look like? To me, it always struck me as it's basically the Navy's version of the GSA Schedules program. I don't know how else to describe it, but that's exactly what I saw it off with, saw it as with the, the number of contractors on it, the way the evaluation is done, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I mean, it was category management or contract consolidation before it was cool, because right. This contract was created in 2004.
But it was at the agency level.
At the agency right. level. And the Navy pushed everyone to move their knowledge-based services, that's engineering services, technical services, logistics support type work, to that contract vehicle. And it was designed in part to put in one place the services supplier base of the Navy. And so that's why it was structured so that there would be a rolling admissions period every year, and pretty much anybody who applies that is a viable business can get on. That's why there's, more than 3,000 companies that have been awarded Z40 positions over time. And that's why there's been more than $5 billion a year of orders flowing through that contract. It's outside of the schedules. It is the largest IDIQ anywhere in government. It'll probably be surpassed by Oasis and Alliant in the coming
future,
years.
Yeah.
And I think partly because the Navy has yet to settle on a follow-on acquisition strategy. So if you think about Alliant, the existing Alliant does not expire until 2019. People can place orders through 2019.
Right.
But Alliant 2 will begin accepting orders as early as 2017. And you kind of have to have that overlap in contract vehicles, because otherwise buyers will think that you're closed for business and
right.
they'll start moving their work elsewhere. And you're already starting to see that with Z40. IDIQ folks call that leakage.
Yes.
Leakage of orders to Oasis from Z40 or to some of the other contract vehicles that the Navy has. And so in a way, it's already too late for the Navy to get started, but they need to start communicating to their
right.
industrial base what's going to happen when 2019 rolls around. And they could just extend it and decide to keep it as it is. It would be relatively easy to just say, okay, we're
reissue
a new
the solicitation.
Process, right?
Or do something like that. Yeah, that's a possibility. Yeah.
But in the near term, I think that means that's good news for GSA's Oasis contract, because it's got an extended period of performance, well into the next decade, and a lot of flexibility to add scope and add contractors over time. So one possibility would be the Navy going to GSA and saying, create me a new pool,
right.
or they probably call it a sub pool, that fits the Navy's needs.
Mm-hmm. Or they could, you also, I don't have mentioned in this show, but the schedules, the professional services schedule.
Or the schedules, right. And I think the schedules are going to start feeling the competitive pressure to lower their fees, in part because GSA itself has lowered the fees on Oasis. And that reducing that hurdle, even though you could make a lot of arguments that those fees really don't cost the agencies in the long run, because they don't have to duplicate
right
existing contracts. But there is a mental hurdle in a lot of the agencies with those fees, and once you lower those fees, I think they become more
Right. Well, one of the things about lowering the fees, it's a market working to a certain extent, right? Because GSA lowers them, as I understand it, in exchange for commitments to use like OASIS, for example,
right.
Like for, you know, 500 million a year or whatever the Air Force agreed to do.
Right.
Right. But that, and that fee is, lowering of the fee is, you know, part of the consideration, I guess, for lack of a better term, for Air Force agreeing to do that.
Yeah. But you also have some of the competing vehicles of other agencies reducing their fees.
Right. Like NIH just reduced their fees, right?
Yep. And SOUP is NASA SOUP, which is for
has a lower
IT
fee.
Purchases, is constantly lowering its fee.
Right.
And so that internal government competition among the vehicles can be a driver for reduced fees too.
Yeah. And the flip side of it is that you got to also still cover your costs though too.
Right.
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 So.
Right.
So you, yeah. So you wonder that if there'd be pressure there for them to look at streamlining processes to, you know, reduce costs,
right?
Or is it going to be people or what? Who knows?
Yeah. I think this is a mid to long term.
Yes. Issue.
Likely not right now, but I think it's a natural consequence of what we're seeing across these vehicles.
Yeah, and it struck me when you were talking about C-40 and they should have, you know, when it. Monday morning quarterback, you know, the idea that needing to get started on a new vehicle and GSA is going to have two in play. I think that my observation there is that perhaps that's, you know, GSA is in this business for like the last forever, right? And they've experienced that and understand that they got to get that, you know, to a certain degree overlap in place to maintain, you know, the expectations for folks and certainty of a marketplace for folks to go. And perhaps, you know, C4E is, you know, not at that same place yet where that sensitivity was in, you know, amongst the folks running it, just because it's a different, it's, you know, animal. I don't know. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah. I think my guess is that at the end of the day, they may just find some way to extend it in,
right,
maybe in a slightly different form. But as a, because all these other vehicles are coming out that have similar scope,
right,
it becomes a not so much a mandatory vehicle, but
well, it's a daunting if you have 3,000 awardees, right? That's a 3,000, you know, 3,000 companies on C4E, is that what you mentioned?
Yeah, and you know, most of them never went in order. So out of the there are about more than 1,700 companies have won C4E contracts just since 2012.
Uh-huh.
And 90% of them, 1,500 of them, have never won a task order beyond the $2,501 minimum guarantee they get. And so, again, you have some excess capacity there.
I wonder what the folks are thinking when they get on the contract. Is it they get that contract as a precursor to some other work they want to do someplace else? Is it sort of like a stamp of approval? Like, that's a lot
there,
of people
there's some
look
of
at
that too,
schedules.
But I think people want to get a return on their investment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
but,
sure.
You know, one of the advantages of these kinds of contract vehicles is you can very quickly get out an order. So the turnaround time on a C4E order, you could issue a $49 million, you know, 3-year task order, and ask for proposals back in 3 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so you have this really fast turnaround. I think a lot of companies get caught by surprise.
They don't realize
they haven't done all the legwork
right
to prepare.
Well, you have to have an infrastructure in place. If you're going to be successful in these idea kids, you have to have the infrastructure in place to be able to respond quickly.
Yeah.
And be, even just identify the opportunities that, you know, fit your wheelhouse.
Right, right. Right.
So real quickly, got about a minute left, man. That went fast. You know, the presidential election, you mentioned to me that, and there was actually a mention of procurement reform. I'm shocked.
You know, I was sitting through, you know, all the candidates on the Republican stage, and I got a little woohoo out because Jeb Bush mentioned that the need for procurement reform after the next election, and that's the first time I remember procurement reform coming up at that level, probably since Al Gore and the toilet seats and hangers. But I think it's safe to say that no matter who wins, there's going to be an imprint of that person on the acquisition system, and the question is just what that imprint will be, And I just think it'll be fascinating to see as we move to the general election, and that's mm-hmm. where we'll start to see the candidates really talking about their management approach.
Right.
And that's where we'll be able to really see what their visions are for it. Donald Trump has put out a position paper on VA reform and talks about inserting more choice into the VA,
mm-hmm.
Into the VA system. I think.
Well, you have a lot to work with.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And just sort of last thing, because we do have to close the show, but, you know, it's like you mentioned at the beginning, big data, you know, it means many different things to different people, depending on where you sit. Procurement reform means many different things to many different people, depending on, you know, your perspective.
That's
so
right. That's
absolutely.
Right.
I want to thank my guest today, Brian Friel of One Nation Analytics. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Fred News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.